Chapter 116. Their boyhood. The old fellow cut in with stories, to the full as choice as any the youngest rake present had to tell, nor did his own gray hairs, nor their smooth faces detain him. Old Mac was famous for his good stories. He was not exactly a ladies' man. That is, men asked him to dine rather at the houses of their mistresses than of their mothers. There can scarcely be a life lower, perhaps, than his, but he was quite contented with it, such as it was, and led it in perfect good nature, simplicity, and modesty of demeanor. By the time Mac had finished a copious breakfast, most of the others had concluded their meal. Young Lord Varinas was smoking an immense meerschaum pipe, while Captain Hugh was employed with a cigar. That violent little devil Tandyman, with his little bull terrier between his legs, was tossing for shillings with all his might. That fellow was always at some game or other, against Captain Deuces. And Mac and Rawdon walked off to the club, neither, of course, having given any hint of the business which was occupying their minds. Both, on the other hand, had joined pretty gaily in the conversation, for why should they interrupt it? Feasting, drinking, ribaldry, laughter, go on alongside of all sorts of other occupations in Vanity Fair. The crowds were pouring out of church as Rawdon and his friend passed down St. James Street and entered into their club. The old bucks and habitues, who ordinarily stand gaping and grinning out of the great front window of the club, had not arrived at their posts as yet. The newspaper room was almost empty. One man was present whom Rawdon did not know, another to whom he owed a little score for whist, and whom, in consequence, he did not care to meet. A third was reading The Royalist, a periodical famous for its scandal, and its attachment to Church and King, Sunday paper at the table, and looking up at Crawley with some interest, said, "Crawley, I congratulate you." "What do you mean?" said the Colonel. "It's in The Observer and The Royalist too," said Mr. Smith. "What?" Rawdon cried, turning very red. He thought that the affair with Lord Steyne was already in the public prints. Smith looked up wondering and smiling at the agitation which the Colonel exhibited as he took up the paper, and, trembling, began to read. "Mr. Smith and Mr. Brown, the gentleman with W. whom Rawdon at the outstanding whist account had been talking about the Colonel just before he came in. It has come just in the nick of time," said Smith. "Suppose Crawley had not a shilling in the world. It's a wind that blows everybody good," Mr. Brown said. "He can't go away without paying me a pony he owes me." "What's the salary?" asked Smith.
2,000 or 3,000, answered the other. "But the climate's so infernal, they don't enjoy it long. Liversidge died after 18 months of it, and the man before went off in 6 weeks, I hear. Some people say his brother is a very clever man. I always found him a D-bore," Smith ejaculated. "He must have good interest, though. He must have got the Colonel the place."
"He," said Brown, with a sneer.
"Ooh, it was Lord Steyne got it."
"How do you mean?"
"A virtuous woman is a crown to her husband," answered the other enigmatically, and went to read his papers. Rawdon, for his part, read in The Royalist the following astonishing paragraph. "Governorship of Coventry Island. HMS Yellowjack, Commander Jaunders, has brought letters and papers from Coventry Island. H.E. Sir Thomas Liversidge had fallen a victim to the prevailing fever at Swampton. His loss is deeply felt in the flourishing colony. We hear that the governorship has been offered to Colonel Rawdon Crawley, C.B.B., a distinguished Waterloo officer. We need not only men of acknowledged bravery, but men of administrative talents, to superintend the affairs of our colonies, and we have no doubt that the gentleman selected by the Colonial Office to fill the lamented vacancy which has occurred at Coventry Island is admirably calculated for the post which he is about to occupy." Coventry Island? Where was it? Who had appointed him to the government? "You must take me out as your secretary, old boy," Captain McMurdo said laughing, and as Crawley and his friend sat wondering and perplexed over the announcement, the club waiter brought into the colonel a card on which the name of Mr. Wenham was engraved, who begged to see Colonel Crawley. The colonel and his aide-de-camp went out to meet the gentleman, rightly conjecturing that he was an emissary of Lord Stang. "How do you do, Crawley? I am glad to see you," said Mr. Wenham with a bland smile, and grasping Crawley's hand with great cordiality. "You come, I suppose, from..."
"Exactly," said Mr. Wenham.
"Then this is my friend Captain McMurdo, of the lifeguards green." "Delighted to know Captain McMurdo, I'm sure," Mr. Wenham said, and tendered another smile and shake of the hand to the second, as he had done to the principal. Mac put out one finger, armed with a buckskin glove, and made a very frigid bow to Mr. Wenham over his tight cravat. He was, perhaps, discontented at being put in communication with a Peckin, and thought that Lord Stang should have sent him a colonel at the very least. "As McMurdo acts for me, and knows what I mean," Crawley said, "I had better retire, and leave you together."
"Of course," said McMurdo.
"By no means, my dear Colonel," Mr. Wenham said. "The interview which I had the honor of requesting was with you personally, though the company of Captain McMurdo cannot fail to be also most pleasing. In fact, Captain, I hope that our conversation will lead to none but the most agreeable results, very different from those which my friend Colonel Crawley appears to anticipate."
"Humph," said Captain McMurdo. "Be hanged to these civilians," he thought to himself, "they are always for arranging and speechifying."
Mr. Wenham took a chair which was not offered to him, took a paper from his pocket, and resumed, "You have seen this gratifying announcement in the papers this morning, Colonel? Government has secured a most valuable servant, a new, if you accept office, as I presume you will, an excellent appointment. $3,000 a year, delightful climate, excellent government house, all your own way in the colony, and a certain promotion. I congratulate you with all my heart. I presume you know, gentlemen, to whom my friend is indebted for this piece of patronage."
"Hanged if I know," the captain said. His principal turned very red.
"To one of the most generous and kindest men in the world, as he is one of the greatest to my excellent friend, the Marquis of Stang. I'll see him before I take his place," growled out Rawdon.
"You are irritated against my noble friend," Mr. Wenham calmly resumed.
"And now, in the name of common sense and justice, tell me why?"
"Why?" cried Rawdon in surprise.
"Why, dammy," said the captain, bringing his stick on the ground.
"Dammy, indeed," said Mr. Wenham with the most agreeable smile. "Still, look at the matter as a man of the world, as an honest man, and see if you have not been in the wrong. You come home from a journey, and find what? My Lord Stang supping at your house in Curzon Street with Mrs. Crawley. Is the circumstance strange or novel? Has he not been 100 times before in the same position? Upon my honor and word as a gentleman," Mr. Wenham here put his hand on his waistcoat with a parliamentary air, "declare I think that your suspicions are monstrous and utterly unfounded, and that they injure an honorable gentleman who has proved his goodwill towards you by 1,000 benefactions, and a most spotless and innocent lady." "You don't mean to say that Crawley's mistaken?" said Mr. McMurdo.
"I believe that Mrs. Crawley is as innocent as my wife, Mrs. Wenham," Mr. Wenham said with great energy.
"Believe that, misled by an infernal jealousy, my friend here strikes a blow against, not only an infirm and old man of high station, his constant friend and benefactor, but against his wife, his own dearest honor, his son's future reputation, and his own prospects in life."
"I will tell you what happened," Mr. Wenham continued with great solemnity. "I was sent for this morning by my Lord Stang, and found him in a pitiable state, as, I need hardly inform Colonel Crawley, any man of age and infirmity would be after a personal conflict with a man of your strength. I say to your face, it was a cruel advantage you took of that strength. Colonel Crawley. It was not only the body of my noble and excellent friend which was wounded, his heart, sir, was bleeding. A man whom he had loaded with benefits and regarded with affection, had subjected him to the foulest indignity. What was this very appointment, which appears in the journals of today, but a proof of his kindness to you? When I saw his lordship this morning, I found him in a state pitiable indeed to see, and as anxious as you are to revenge the outrage committed upon him by blood. You know he has given his proofs, I presume, Colonel Crawley? He has plenty of pluck, said the colonel. Oh, but he ever said he hadn't. His first order to me was to write a letter of challenge, and to carry it to Colonel Crawley. One or other of us, he said, must not survive the outrage of last night. Crawley nodded. We're coming to the point, Wenham, he said. I tried my utmost to calm Lord Stan. Good God! Sir, I said, how I regret that Mrs. Wenham and myself had not accepted Mrs. Crawley's invitation to sup with her. She asked you to sup with her? Captain McMurdo said. After the opera. Here's the note of invitation. Stop. No, this is another paper I thought I had H, but it's of no consequence, and I pledge you my word to the fact. If we had come, and it was only one of Mrs. Wenham's headaches which prevented us, she suffers under them a good deal, especially in the spring. If we had come, and you had returned home, there would have been no quarrel, no insult, no suspicion, and so it is positively because my poor wife has a headache, that you are to bring death down upon two men of honor and plunge two of the most excellent and ancient families in the kingdom into disgrace and sorrow. Mr. McMurdo looked at his principal with the air of a man profoundly puzzled, and Rawdon felt with a kind of rage that his prey was escaping him. He did not believe a word of the story, and yet, how discredit or disprove it? Mr. Wenham continued with the same fluent oratory, which in his place in Parliament he had, so often practiced, sat for an hour or more by Lord Steyne's bedside, beseeching, imploring Lord Steyne to forego his intention of demanding a meeting. I pointed out to him that the circumstances were after all suspicious. They were suspicious. I acknowledge it, any man in your position might have been taken in, I said, that a man furious with jealousy is to all intents and purposes a madman, and should be as such regarded, that a duel between you must lead to the disgrace of all parties concerned, that a man of his lordship's exalted station had no right in these days, when the most atrocious revolutionary principles and the most dangerous leveling doctrines are preached among the vulgar, to create a public scandal, and that, however innocent, the common people would insist that he was guilty. In fine, I implored him not to send the challenge. I don't believe one word of the whole story, said Rawdon, grinding his teeth. Believe it a lie, and that you're in it, Mr. Wenham. If the challenge don't come from him, by Jove it shall come from me. Mr. Wenham turned deadly pale at this savage interruption of the colonel and looked towards the door. But he found a champion in Captain McMurdo. That gentleman rose up with an oath, and rebuked Rawdon for his language. Who put the affair into my hands, and you shall act as I think fit, by Jove, and not as you do. You have no right to insult Mr. Wenham with this sort of language. And damme, Mr. Wenham, you deserve an apology. And as for a challenge to Lord Steyne, you may get somebody else to carry it, I won't. If my lord, after being thrashed, chooses to sit still, damme let him. And as for the affair with Mrs. Crawley, my belief is, there's nothing proved at all. That your wife's innocent as Mr. Wenham says she is, and at any rate, that you would be a fool not to take the place and hold your tongue. Captain McMurdo, you speak like a man of sense, Mr. Wenham cried out, immensely relieved. Forget any words that Colonel Crawley has used in the irritation of the moment. I thought you would, Rawdon said with a sneer. Shut your mouth, you old stupid, the captain said good-naturedly. Mr. Wenham ain't a fighting man, and quite right too. This matter, in my belief, the Steyne emissary cried, ought to be buried in the most profound oblivion. A word concerning it should never pass these doors. I speak in the interest of my friend, as well as of Colonel Crawley, who persists in considering me his enemy. I suppose Lord Stang won't talk about it very much, said Captain McMurdo, and I don't see why our side should. The affair ain't a very pretty one, any way you take it, and the less said about it the better. It's you are thrashed, and not us. And if you are satisfied, why, I think, we should be. Mr. Wenham took his hat, upon this, and Captain McMurdo following him to the door, shut it upon himself and Lord Stang's agent, leaving Rawdon chafing within. When the two were on the other side, McMurdo looked hard at the other ambassador, and with an expression of anything but respect on his round jolly face. You don't stick at a trifle, Mr. Wenham, he said. You flatter me, Captain McMurdo, answered the other with a smile. Upon my honor and conscience now, Mrs. Crawley did ask us to sup after the opera. Of course, and Mrs. Wenham had one of her headaches. I say, I've got a £1,000 note here, which I will give you, if you will give me a receipt please, and I will put the note up in an envelope for Lord Stang. My man shan't fight him. But we had rather not take his money. It was all a mistake, my dear sir, the other said with the utmost innocence of manner, and was bowed down the club steps by Captain McMurdo, just as Sir Pitt Crawley ascended them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.